on this theme of looking at how gravity and field theories interact. And in particular, I want to focus on non-perturbative solutions in field theory. Now, I'm not sure whether anything like this has been covered. Anna, is? Yeah, so I mean, typically when you learn field theory, what you're interested in is perturbative field theory. You're looking at quantizing the field theory. You're looking at excitations around the vacuum. So if you were imagining doing some sort of quasi-classical version of that on a classical geometry, you might imagine that you could do that by taking some vacuum solution to the Einstein equations and just wiggling it a little bit, just perturbing it. So we probably look at gravitational perturbation theory next week, but this week I want to still look at sort of macroscopic gravitating solutions like the black hole. Although you can make the mass of a black hole arbitrarily small, it's not really a perturbation of the vacuum because it has this event horizon. So that makes it quite distinct structurally from the vacuum. And so this is the same sort of theme here, except looking in the context of solutions to full solutions with gravity and a field theory. So let me just put some of those words down. So our question today is, what about things that are not close to a vacuum? So for example, Hawking's original calculation for an evaporator or evaporation from a black hole was done by putting field theory on the classical background of a black hole. So it's that sort of approach. It wasn't in any sense solving fully coupled Einstein field theory equations. So I'm going to look at an example in detail today, which we call a domain wall. I'll first cover what the non-perturbative solution is in the context of field theory, and then we'll start to add gravity. And although we'll be doing this in a specific example, this notion, as we'll see, of some solution which is vacuum or an Einstein solution at one end, goes through some stuff in the middle, and then ends up in another, different Einstein solution, that transports to a sort of wider variety of situations. So what's a domain wall? So we saw yesterday how to put gravity on the same footing as field theory by deriving the Einstein-Hilbert action, and I'd use the free scalar field as a means of motivating the definition of the energy momentum tensor, looking at the equations of motion, checking that, you know, the root g is the measure on our manifold was all nice and consistent. So today we want to look at adding now an interacting scalar field. And I'm going to take a particular example of a potential which has a non-trivial structure. So here, our potential, it's a real scalar, and our potential has two distinct vacua. should hit the bottom there, but never mind. Now, this is an example of spontaneous symmetry breaking in field theory, in the sense that this potential has a Z2 symmetry. You can flip it around the axis. But if you want to quantize the theory, you have to pick a vacuum, either plus or minus eta, and then you look at the excitations around that vacuum. We're going to do something different. Let's look at our equation of motion. And let's imagine we want to do something a little weird. We want to look at a solution where over on that side of the room, we're in the negative vacuum, and over on that side of the universe, we're in the positive vacuum. I suppose I should have set up and down if I was going to label it with the Z coordinate. So here, I'm not including gravity as a first step. Yep.
Are you
using a square in the potential? Oh, yeah, thanks. Sorry. Thank you. Well spotted. Are there any other little slips there? I don't think so. So because I'm not considering gravity for the moment, Z is just a usual Cartesian coordinate. So our equation of motion, if we think we've got a setup, let's just look for a Z-dependent solution. Our equation of motion is going to reduce to phi double prime minus phi double prime plus 2 lambda phi, phi squared minus eta squared is 0. Now we can actually take a first integral of this by multiplying by phi primed. Just in case it helps us. But actually, you can see reasonably easily that we can construct a solution which interpolates between these two different vacua by simply writing down the Tansch solution. So our derivative of Tansch is sec squared, so that's your phi primed. And Tansch squared minus 1 is also sec squared. So, sorry, 1 minus Tansch squared is sec squared. And so you can see that here, functionally, this is sec to the fourth, as is that. And in fact, you see that these two terms are equal. And our constant, or almost equal, our constant should be I thought the constant was 0. It is 0. Just forgot a factor of 2. Obviously, I'm missing my 2s this morning. Okay, so this is a solution which interpolates between two vacua. why is it non-perturbative? So what we usually mean by a perturbative solution is something which is intuitively close to a vacuum solution. So we might imagine that we can get to our perturbative solution from the vacuum through a set of field configurations, which may or may not solve equations of motion, but there's a continuous route, and each of those field configurations have finite energy. Now, we can go from this solution to the true vacuum by, if I sketch the solution, I could pick up the left-hand side and lift it up to phi equals eta, or take the right-hand side and drop it down to phi is minus eta. However, if I were to do that, it would mean I would have to lift over an infinite region of space from one vacuum to the other, and that would cost me an infinite amount of energy. So there's a barrier between this kink, as it's called, and either one of the true vacua, an infinite energy barrier. So it's in a distinct class from either phi equals minus eta or phi equals plus eta. So let's just look at the properties of this kink. Typically, tanh is very well approximated by 1 or minus 1, and it's only significantly different from 1 or minus 1 when its argument is sort of order 1, so over the region where root lambda eta z is of order 1. So we can associate a width to this kink of 1 over root lambda eta. Well, it's 2, I suppose, but so notice that that's essentially the mass of our scalar excitations, or the inverse mass of the scalar excitations. So there's a natural scale in this potential of root lambda eta, and this crops up both in terms of when you quantize the theory, looking at the mass of the scalar particles, and also in the width of this kink. So if I look at the energy momentum tensor, so it's twice times the variation of the Lagrangian with respect to the metric. So I've got just the free derivatives of phi, and then I've got the term proportional to the metric coming from the root g piece. So the first term is only non-zero if I'm looking at a z-index. And then the second term, well, if I look at my Lagrangian, it's going to be minus phi prime squared over 2. And then minus v. But I saw that actually these two terms are the same, and they're both equal to a half of this term here, half phi prime squared. So overall, there's a common factor, functional factor, dependent on z of such to the fourth. Now, of course, I've put g here, but it's really eta because we're looking at flat space. But I'm sort of, you know, partly thinking ahead. So this tells me that if if I look at the ZZ component, it's zero, because the two terms cancel in that square bracket. But if I look at the sort of parallel XY T components, then it's this such to the fourth function. So I've centered the thing at z equals zero. So what this energy momentum tensor looks like, it depends on the value of root lambda eta, but it's extremely localized around the origin of the kink. And it looks like it's not really a cosmological constant because it's not a constant function, but it's in terms of the x, y, and t subplane or submanifold of the four-dimensional Minkowski space, it's sort of like a cosmological constant. So this looks like some number times approximately, it's a smeared out delta function. So we've got a sort of lambda eta to the fourth factor outside, but in fact, I'm going to split that sort of up into a lambda eta squared times an eta squared piece. So it's not really a delta function, but it's very sharp. So if I just say, if I integrate the energy density through the kink, then I get something finite, so I've got a finite value of my energy, but it's an energy per unit area. So although our energy per unit area is finite, unfortunately, this solution, because it sits at z equals zero, it has infinite area. So overall, it has infinite energy. So typically in gravity, where we look at things that are isolated systems, on average, and so we're used to dealing with this notion of finite energy, except, of course, when it comes to cosmology, because in principle, the universe could have, in some sense, an infinite energy. But it's not a silly thing to do to look at the universe. So in this case, although this has infinite area, I'm still going to go ahead and ask the question, how does it gravitate? Because just because something has infinite area doesn't mean that it's going to be singular or not have a good gravitational solution. So let's ask now, how do we add in gravity? So when we're trying to find solutions in Einstein gravity, we always have to think about gauge. what is going to be our choice of coordinates? Now, yep. So what I'm thinking here is I'm approximating, so the kink is a nice continuous interpolation between the two different vacua of the field theory, okay?
So I'm thinking we started with flat space.
Yeah.
This is the solution of flat space.
That's right.
How can we say that something is localized everywhere there's a translation symmetry?
Well, actually, you've broken the translation symmetry partially here, because your kink is at z equals zero, but it doesn't depend, the solution doesn't depend on x or y. So it's true, you can still translate in the xy plane. You can also translate in t. You can also, because these three are equal, do Lorentz boosts in xy and, sorry, in xt and yt. So you've got a subset of your Lorentz group that remains unbroken by this solution. However, the Z translations have been broken because if I sit here, I'm in the middle of the wall. If I sit over here, I'm on one side. If I'm here, I'm on the other side. So now the Z translations have been broken, but there is a sort of zero mode of this wall in the sense of you can put it at z equals zero, z equals one, z equals two, so on and so forth. And it's in some sense the same solution, it's just been shifted. So it's got the same energy, but it's just been shifted. But you have broken the full Lorentz group because you put something down. It's like saying that, you know, in this, I've put a sheet of paper here, so I've broken my vertical translation symmetries in this room. You mean that it would just break one? Because it's a real scalar, you mean?
Well, because I'm assuming those are five functions of position.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that particular potential zeroes out or singles out the point zero in spacetime, and that's why I.
No, not so much, Zeddy. I didn't really want to keep writing Z minus Z zero. It was my laziness that put it at Z equals zero. So if this is going to cause confusion, let me just put a note. So so that's the general solution. I was just looking, you know, to look for the main properties of the kink, which were the fact that it interpolated between one vacuum, the minus here, and the plus vacuum over there. And in between, it's got to come away from its vacuum value, so there's some energy density. And the energy density is this sharply peaked such to the fourth function. So that's the kink. It has an integration constant in it, but that's just telling you the position of the wall. And it maintains its Lorentz symmetry, which is actually going to be important anyway. So if we want to add gravity, we have to think about a choice of gauge. And here is where we use a sort of physical input, asking questions, well, what do we expect this object to look like? What properties does it have? Well, the main property that it has is that it has this equality of its energy momentum components. And so it has this boost symmetry of in the T, X, and Y directions. And so this suggests that you would have a constant curvature space-time. Now, you do this. This is exactly analogous to what you do in looking for a Freeman-Robertson-Walker cosmology, only in that case, everything depends on time, and you have usually an isotropic and homogeneous space. In that case, you argue it from observation. And your energy momentum tensor there has all the pressures, Px equals Py equals Pz, or whatever. There's an isotropic pressure. So there's that same notion there of homogeneity and isotropy. Now, there's perhaps slightly less reason here to take that over, but it's certainly a consistent thing to do, and so you kind of proceed with the simplest possible thing and see if it works. And only if it doesn't work do you go back and make things more complicated. So that means we're considering this sort of metric. So this is exactly like the Friedman-Robertson-Walker. So let me just check. Anna, was this a tutorial question or a homework?
I'm sorry, yeah.
Yeah. And so it's finished now. Okay, right. So this here, I want to just take a little bit of time to go over this because I'm going to kind of use this as a basic cookery ingredient to build more complicated space-times. And this is sometimes known as a warped compactification. In the sense that it's taking you, your z is an extra direction, and the dimensionality of this space is d minus 1 if the dimensionality of the full space is d. So it's looking at reducing from d to d minus 1 in terms of your metric components. So if we use our Cartan formalism here, we would say our omega z was dz, and omega A So we're going to say that the one forms of the remaining part of the metric are this conformal factor A times whatever the appropriate one forms are for this gamma, which I'm not really interested in the details. They're going to come along for the ride in this calculation. So again, my method tells me, and I'm just going to, you can hack the indices if you want as you go through. So if I take d omega A, first of all, my d sees this A of Z prefactor, so I get an A primed, and then converting the omega naught back to an omega gives me 1 over A, and of course dz is just omega Z, so that's the first piece. And then the second piece is where d hits the omega naught, and then whatever that is, it's simply by Cartan's first structural equation is going to be the background connection one forms for the metric gamma. Obviously, d omega z is zero. And so I can simply read off the fact that if I just keep my indices in the d minus one dimensional subspace, I've got the background connection one forms. If I look at a mixed component, I pick up a factor of a primed on a. And then I compute the curvature two form. So I use Cartan's second equation and sum over all possible values of that index. So you can see the first piece is just R naught. And then my second piece I get one minus sign from lowering the z-index and another minus sign from flipping the order of the z and the b. But then in terms of raising the index, I have to use, because this is an orthonormal basis, I have to use the Minkowski metric, eta. And so this time I'm putting it in explicitly, because obviously if the c was a t-index, I wouldn't get a sign from raising it. And if it wasn't, then I would. So I've now written down explicitly what R naught AB is. So remember, when you form the curvature two form, you do it by taking the Riemann tensor and mopping up the last pair of indices with connection one form basis elements. So now if I look at RAZ, then that's going to be d theta AZ. So that's going to be A double primed on A, omega Z cross omega A. Then it's going to have a d of omega naught A there, which is theta naught AB cross omega B. And then finally, there's a term theta AB wedge theta BZ. So theta AB is theta naught AB. Wedge theta BZ. And theta BZ is just A primed on A times omega B. So those two pieces cancel. So from this, I can see that if I want to peel off what my Riemann tensor is in this orthonormal basis, I've obviously got an R naught, the background Riemann tensor, a factor of 1 over A to change the omega naughts into omegas. And then I have to, my second piece is just proportional to terms involving the metric, but I have to make sure that they're properly anti-symmetric. So that's why I get two of these pieces here. Now I really want the coordinate basis. So in order to get that, the cheap and easy way is simply to raise this second index here. And you can see that if I look at the mu z terms, so if I look at RAZ, what it does is it picks out the A component here, that's plus sign, sorry, picks out the A component, so I need to have a delta AB or delta mu nu when I go to the coordinate basis, and the signs I get from saying the order is AZ, BZ, so I have to flip that, that's one minus sign, and then there's another minus sign from raising that Z coordinate. So that gives me the Riemann tensor, yep.
Could you just repeat how you got
yeah.
the bottom line?
So the bottom line, so the curvature 2 form, you can see from going from this expression here over to that expression there, the curvature 2 form is given by the Riemann tensor with the last two anti-symmetric indices mopped up by basis elements. And so typically, it's a two form, so there's a combinatorial factor there of a half, because when you sum over C and D here, you know, you say, for example, C equals 1, D equals 2 is the same as C equals 2, D equals 1, so that's a combinatorial factor. And so that I want to peel off my Riemann tensor, which is on the left-hand side here. And so I see I've got an R naught there, but this R naught is given in terms of the background basis one forms, not the, so those are the D minus one basis one forms as opposed to the D basis one forms. And there's a factor of A involved in that. So if I want to remove omega zero here, I have to divide by A squared, hence that factor there. So that's the first piece. And then the second piece, there's the functional bit, a primed on a squared. And so when you look at the sort of pattern here, you know that here is R, A, B, C, D. I would have, if I were constructing the curvature 2 form, I'd be sort of summing over that. So you can see that there's a free index A here, so you have to change the C to an A. So that's that first delta AC. And then here you've got eta BC, well, this would be a D, so these two indices are the same, so that's why it's eta BD there. However, because this is anti-symmetric on C and D here, this has to be anti-symmetric on C and D, therefore, I subtract off C reversed with D. So that's how I read it off by looking at this expression here. So you are in the background, what you're doing is you're trying to make sure that if I take this expression for my Riemann tensor and sum, construct my two form by summing over omega c wedge omega d, I get this expression here. But I have to make sure that my Riemann tensor has the right symmetries. In particular, it's anti-symmetric in C and D. So that's why sometimes you have to add some extra pieces when you sort of lift expressions off. So that's how that was constructed. And I think the bits that are key, it's picking up this factor here, which comes from going from omega naught to omega, and also just making sure you've got the symmetries right in here. And so you see that once you've constructed that, this now has the right symmetries for a constant curvature space. So this would be, if you just looked at this piece in brackets here, this would be the Riemann tensor of a constant curvature space. So you'd see that cropping up for pure de Sitter, pure anti-de Sitter. So I just want to pick off the Ricci tensor, and you see that, again, there's only two things you need to identify: the transverse component, so that's dependent on that transverse Z coordinate, and then the parallel components, which should be highly symmetric. So in our case, D is 4, so this would go to 3, A double primed on A, and this would go to 2A primed on A squared. And if I want a constant curvature space-time, then my Ricci tensor is just proportional to something, some constant and a length scale. Okay, so that was a slight, I wanted to go through that in detail, mainly because when you're constructing solutions to Einstein equations, quite often what you're doing is using basic building blocks so that you don't need to start absolutely from scratch each time. Quite often you're piecing together different sort of components. So for example, with the black hole, you had a time component, you had with its sort of pre-multiplying function, everything dependent on a radial coordinate. And then you had this S2. Because of the SO3 symmetry, Killing symmetry of the background, you had these invariant two spheres, so the metric didn't change. So you have this SO3 symmetry of the metric. And so that meant you had this S2, that's a constant curvature space, And so in that case, you saw that there was always this factor, if you see there, kappa over L squared A squared. In that case, the function was C, but there was always that 1 over C squared coming along for the ride. So in terms of building solutions to Einstein equations, quite often what you're doing is you're piecing together different building blocks. And so here is an example with a single building block, the D minus 1 dimensional constant curvature subspace, with an extra direction. And so now you can start sort of putting more of those building blocks together. So I just wanted to show this one in gory detail. So in our case, what we want to solve to find where I wrote down dv/dφ. There we are. Okay, so what we want to solve, ideally, is this system of equations. We've got our gravity equations. gAb is 8 pi gTab. Our energy momentum tensor, in general, will be a little bit different from the flat space energy momentum tensor, but we're still looking for something that depends only on that z coordinate, and therefore it actually splits up again into something relatively straightforward. The 0, 0, xx, and yy components are all the same, so phi is phi of z, and they're the sum of the potential and kinetic pieces, whereas the transverse component, gzz, is the difference. So this is 0 in flat space, and this is this set to the fourth function in flat space. In terms of the wave equation, we use the expression for the wave operator given in terms of our square root of the metric and partial derivatives. Well, the square root of root g is just a cubed. And so this is very nearly what we had in flat space in the sense that it starts off, we've got phi double primed, but we've now got an additional term involving a coupling between the curvature of the space, sort of as measured by A primed, and the derivative of phi. So structurally there's a lot of similarity, but you can see that the detail is going to be different. So let's just have a look at, let's imagine that if we sort of think about a situation where 8 pi g eta squared is small. Mm-hmm.
On the right side of that equation, how do we get the energy momentum tensor?
So if we go back to the expression for the energy momentum tensor over here that I wrote down on this board, T mu nu, that is true. That's completely general. So all I've done there is I've taken phi as phi of z, and so if I look at, let's say I'm looking at the 0, 0 component, if phi is a function of z, those first two derivatives don't give you anything because there's no time dependence. So I can see that all it is dependent on is the value of the Lagrangian. If I step up again to the board at the top, then I can see that if phi is z dependent, that's minus a half phi prime squared minus v of phi. So that's where I get my sum of the potential and kinetic pieces for t naught naught. And so that's going to be the same for the xx and the yy. Whereas for the z component, I've still got that same term, L phi g mu nu, but now I've got a phi prime squared out the front. And so that takes that plus a half phi prime squared into minus a half phi prime squared. So you see this pattern kind of repeating. When you've got a potential in the Lagrangian, that gives you something like a cosmological constant. It always contributes to energy momentum with the same sign. When you have kinetic pieces, you see that they contribute positively to T naught naught, and then they flip sign when you have a component on which your field depends. So here the field is Z dependent, so it's flipped sign. So that's sort of what it looks like. Mm-hmm.
Why don't you have a, because your new metric is the thing in the red box. Mm-hmm.
One index up, one index down.
Oh.
So, yeah. So it's because I've taken a diagonal component. So really, you've got to, you raise the index of G, you get delta. Any further questions before I do the last lap? Yeah.
We're a little bit like puzzled about the motivation for this kind of metric. So you're considering a particular field configuration of phi, right?
Mm-hmm.
These boundary conditions and set, but what about boundary conditions on x and y?
So at the moment, I'm going to come back and say something about that once we've got the solution. At the moment, because my phi field is independent of x and y, I'm not really thinking about x, y, or indeed t for that matter. I am assuming that my solution just has this translation invariance or Lorentz invariance in t, x, and y. So that's, it could be a plane, it could be a sphere, well, de Sitter. Or it could possibly be hyperbolic at this point. I'm not sort of prejudging what that gamma is. But at the moment, I'm saying that because it doesn't depend on x and y, I'm not as yet concerned with what happens to the x and y coordinate. So in terms of the flat space solution, the wall goes on forever. It is a genuine sort of separation between z greater than 0 and z less than 0, roughly speaking. So, but it goes on infinitely far in the x and y directions.
Right, so is that like a physical sensible solution? Because if my field goes to plus or minus infinity in x and y, shouldn't that have problems with energy conservation or stuff like this?
Well, it doesn't necessarily have to have problems with energy conservation, because energy conservation is just some it is a sort of local statement on TAB. So what you could worry about, and, you know, I remarked when I said finite, but z equals 0 has infinite area, you could be worried about that. So at the moment, what I'm doing is I'm just proceeding step by step. I'm not going to throw something out without having tried it first, okay? So I want to see if this is a sensible gravitational solution. Can I get a solution? Then I'm going to come back and answer this question by saying, but how does it get around these issues? What, you know, what happens? Okay? So in fact, there's quite a neat resolution to your question, but I don't want to give you the spoiler just yet, so we'll get there very soon. Yeah?
The last thing is that, so you're choosing this kind of hyper potential with this
two minima.
Right? But you're considering it to be eta to be a number in here.
No, it's an energy scale.
Sure, but I mean, why should we expect, like, for example, the vacuum field configuration is independent of the coordinate or the position in space? But I can have, like, a very weird geometry where my vacuum solution could be dependent on the coordinates, right? I mean, it's just another field configuration that...
Sorry, I'm not sure. I mean, it is... So the vacuum is dependent on the coordinates in the sense that on the left it's the minus vacuum and on the right it's the plus vacuum, but you mean something more than that?
Yeah, I mean like eta as a function of x.
So you want, but then how would that be relativistically invariant because your x or any individual coordinate chart has no independent geometrical meaning. However, you're good at getting me off on red herrings. However, what's interesting about it, the notion that you might have something which is, in a broader sense, position dependent, that there is some sort of corresponding situations where you can go from for example, one region where you've got one cosmological constant and another region where you have a different cosmological constant. So you can't do that by saying cosmological constant is dependent on coordinates, but in that case, it's actually one of these domain wall solutions. In that case, you kind of have your cosmological constant in the sense of one of these, I suppose in our case, four forms, where you make it now into a field where it has one, you know, expectation value here and a different expectation value there. So you can't make constants dependent on coordinates, but you can promote things that, you know, you might initially think were constant. We saw this yesterday with the gravitational constant and changing that into a field. You can promote something into a field. So if you wanted to do that, you'd have to make that eta into an actual, another scalar field, which perhaps had a different potential, telling you that in one region, eta was, say, 10 or half the Planck scale or whatever, and in another region, it was zero. So you can imagine by coupling in more fields, changing either the vacuum expectation value of your field or the mass of the field. So those are things you can do, but you can't make it explicitly coordinate dependent. You have to turn it into a field. So, okay. So I'm going to have to get my skates on here. So in this case, by saying 8 pi g eta squared is much less than 1, you're saying that basically eta is somewhat below the Planck scale, which is a reasonable thing to say. And then your terms on the right-hand side of the Einstein equations are things which depend on this parameter, which I'm going to say is small, times something which is like the width of the wall squared, or a sort of area function, a canonical unit of area of the wall. So given that on the left-hand side, dimensionally, that's 1 over L squared, I can simply say, well, I expect this factor here, sorry, that's width to the minus 2, I expect this factor of lambda eta squared on the right-hand side, because the rate of change of my fields ought to be given by the scale of the fields that constitute the wall, and that has a mass scale, root lambda eta. So this is just setting the scale. Or an energy scale. And this now is telling you about the gravitational interaction. And I'm saying that I'm going to just have a look at a situation where that is small. And so this tells me I can solve my equations of motion perturbatively. So this doesn't mean that I'm close to flat space necessarily. It's just saying that I can write my A function as 1 plus order epsilon, and my phi function as the tanh plus a correction. So let me just look. At what my solutions are. So away from the wall, my energy momentum vanishes, so that tells me that my Einstein tensor has to vanish. So if I, and indeed my Ricci tensor has to vanish. So it tells me that A double primed has to be zero. And here, A prime squared has to be kappa on L squared. So this tells me kappa has to be positive. So it tells me, therefore, that my gamma mu nu is essentially a de Sitter type of solution. So if it was, it's the equivalent of a sphere. So this is saying that A should look something like 1 minus, 1 plus or minus, sorry, Z over L. So this is the general shape of the solution away from the wall. So now I have to try and say, well, okay, here's my sort of general asymptote. I've now got to look at how this fits with this perturbative solution as I integrate through the wall. So now I use my kink, because that's my zeroth order solution here, and I input that on the right-hand side of my Einstein equations. So if I isolate the function A double primed, so I'm really, I guess, not explicitly using either of those Einstein equations, but rather a combination, then I find that A double primed is zero, except in this core, this blip, so to speak, where the setch to the fourth function becomes different from zero. So I can integrate that up, and I find A primed is a combination of tanh. And I'm going to set A primed to be 0 at z equals 0 simply by looking for a symmetric solution. So that's why I've taken that particular form. And then this tells me that gives me this L in terms of epsilon. So it tells me if epsilon is small, this scale is large. And then I integrate up further, and I find my function . So I'm not saying that, you know, this is necessarily easy to see straight off. I'm just telling you these are what the solutions are. Now, if I look at the solution, if I look at large Z, this is just a constant. This term has damped right down to zero. Cosh is roughly exponential of root lambda e to Z plus or minus. So if I look at root lambda e to Z somewhat larger, I get that this is roughly 1 minus 2 thirds epsilon, and then it's root lambda e to z, well, plus or minus root lambda e to z. And so you can see that that has the right form of 1 plus or minus z over L. So this looks right, but what happens as z goes to plus or minus L, because it looks as if I've got an event horizon. So this comes back to the question that I had about what happens if I try to go to large X and Y. So it looks like there's an event horizon. Or is it a singularity? Now, it shouldn't really be a singularity, because when I wrote down that solution in the middle board over there, I was just solving for flat space. So unless I've done something, you know, really mean, it really shouldn't be something singular. What actually happens is that I've written down flat space in a rather bizarre coordinate system. This is really what I've done. So you said you were worried about X and Y being infinite. However, a constant curvature space-time, de Sitter space, written in global coordinates, has a compact spatial section. So I started off, I was sneaky. I didn't actually write down X and Y. I just wrote down gamma. And I didn't presuppose anything about whether spatial sections of gamma were compact or non-compact. I just noted that potentially, at least the flat space kink had infinite area. But what we see when we couple in gravity is that gravity solves that infinite area problem for us, because space spontaneously compactifies. Our de Sitter space now has compact sections. And so what our wall actually looks like is we have to have Minkowski space, So what's happened, roughly speaking, Lucien's going to hate me. What our wall is a, if I take Minkowski space and I choose a coordinate system which is based on this hyperboloid, then I get this type of metric. And this is my, I'm not saying that I've proved this, I'm just telling you this is what it is. This is my wall. This is my z greater than zero. And then I take two copies of that, because I said it was symmetric, and my z less than zero is also the exterior of a hyperboloid. Now that takes some getting used to. I'm not saying it's obvious, in fact it's anything but. However, we're going to look at this from a different perspective, where we imagine the wall is now infinitesimally thin, it's just some plane living in space-time, and then we'll look at gravitational equations for that as submanifold, and we'll see it gives us exactly the same picture. So at the moment, what we've done is we've taken a field theory with a non-perturbative solution, a wall, so it's also known as a topological defect. We've then said, let's find the gravity. Let's not try and be sort of prejudge the issue. We're just going to go step by step. Let's look for a solution, see if we can get something sensible. It turns out we do. We get something which makes sense as a solution, but might have a horizon or a singularity. But if I stop and step back, I see away from the wall, I've got flat space and funny coordinates in actually a sort of hyperbolic coordinate system. My infinite energy has been truncated by gravity. Gravity solved the problem. Space has spontaneously compactified, as in it's now got finite size spatial sections. And the wall can be interpreted, although takes a bit of time to kind of sort of fully appreciate it, as just a vacuum, two vacuum solutions sewn together. Right, before I get hung, drawn, and quartered, I better.